Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 46, which features a live recording from a professional development workshop on classics in organizational and management theory, held at the 78th annual meeting of the Academy of Management in Chicago. To learn more about the event, please visit our new website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This workshop was intended to raise interest towards classic authors and ideas in the field of organization and management theory. So, it echoes the goal of our podcast to disseminate ideas about organizational theory with a special focus on the classics. The rationale for the workshop is that our field, although relatively young, seems sometimes more attentive to disruptions than continuities, novelty instead of tradition. So we hope too that the workshop would help making us more aware regarding connections between earlier and current scholarship, and enable us to explore how ideas, concepts, approaches from the classics, broadly understood, might better equip us to understand current affairs. The workshop included four senior scholars, and each one of them presented about the work of an author they believe is important for organization and management theory. The audience was made up of participants from the Academy of Management annual meeting. We were oversubscribed this year, so apologies for those who could not be included in the event. The good news is that you can now listen to the presentations from the workshop. Also, we are already planning the next year's workshop for the Academy of Management 2019, in which we hope to accommodate a larger crowd, and that workshop will probably focus on contingent theory, so stay tuned for news about that. The first speaker was Paul Adler, who is professor of management and organization and sociology and environmental studies at the University of Southern California. Paul focused on the work of Karl Marx, an author that needs little introduction, and who was one of the most important social scientists in history, and lived between 1818 and 1883. So, if he was still alive, he would be celebrating his birthday of 200 years this year.
All right, what a treat it is to get to talk with you all today about Marx and to hear these other presentations about such other interesting speakers. Let me just begin by stepping back and talking a little bit about why bother with these classic authors. So some of you might have come across this utterance from Alfred North Whitehead, "A science which to forget its founders is lost." A lot of our colleagues, I think, love this idea. I think it's stupid. I think the social sciences are deeply committed to renewing their engagement with the classics for a variety of reasons. I love this essay by Jeffrey Alexander. I encourage you to go look it up. Basically, social sciences can't avoid these value-laden debates, unlike the natural sciences. And as a result, in our field, paradigm conflict is endemic. It's not like we move successively from Newtonian physics to Einsteinian physics. All these paradigms are in our orbit, there's our intellectual orbit. And to that extent, social sciences, it seems to me, lie somewhere between the natural sciences and the pure humanities in the relative importance of current work vis-a-vis older work. We need to be paying attention to both the older classics and the more current stuff. The classics in our field, in social sciences, serve as shorthand signifiers of whole constellations of thought, which have proven their enduring fruitfulness, and also an inspiration for us. When you go back and read, whether it's Mary Douglas or Albert Hirschman or Mary Parker Follett or Karl Marx, once you've made your way past the superficial differences in vocabulary associated with the different time periods in which they were writing, all of a sudden you discover all the things we're talking about today, they were already actual in their minds at the time. There's some elements, obviously, that have disappeared in history, but a lot of it is incredibly relevant. So I encourage you to dig into it. It was that inspiration that led me to edit this book a few years back on sociology and organization studies, the classical foundations. We have a lot of really terrific people writing articles about all these wonderful authors in our earlier history, pre-World War II history, or for the main part, pre-World War II history. And then Oxford, being Oxford, they couldn't resist adding a second volume where we went to the more contemporary period. We moved away from classics, and so here you've got a whole slew of more contemporary writers too. But some of these people are 50 years old, so for most of you in the room, they may as well be classics too. So. Why Marx? I would say why Marx, because today a lot of the central ideas in Marx's analysis seem rather relevant. Marx's basic story, I think, you could summarize fairly straightforwardly. Capitalism is not the last series in the forms of society that humanity is likely to witness. God help us if it's the best humanity can do for itself. We've seen other forms of society in history, and the chances are pretty good that there'll be something superior to capitalism that comes along sooner or later. But the failures of capitalism seem all too obvious. In many ways, it seems like the new technologies are simply stretching the boundaries of what's possible given the constraints of capitalist relations of production, capitalist ownership, the property relations, the market process, the multiplication of failures, whether they're social, environmental, or economic, or political, seems all too obvious to the naked eye. And lots of people seem to see out there through the mists of their fantasies and delusions, perhaps, or through their rose-colored glasses, or just looking microscopically at all sorts of interesting, innovative organizational forms that seem to suggest a successor system to capitalism. So we've got some ideas about what that socialistic system that might succeed capitalism looks like. And indeed, some sense that there are social forces out there that might one day carry us forward rather than backwards in a society's evolution. That said, Marx is a difficult author for us to deal with. Multifaceted in his poetry, right? So we've got economics, we've got philosophy, we've got history. In the world of academia in which we live, that degree of interdisciplinarity is uncomfortable, it's jarring. You're not sure that you can pick up Marx's sociologist without also somehow immersing yourself in the history and the politics and the philosophy. That makes it difficult. Plus, it's expressed in a Hegelian idiom, which some people love, and once you get used to it, feels very liberating. But boy, until you get comfortable with it, it just sounds like gibberish and obfuscation. So that's not easy to deal with. And interestingly, whether it's in our graduate programs, in sociology, let alone economics or political science, people get very little exposure to Marx, certainly in management studies. Very few people in their graduate studies have had any exposure to this literature. All the organized political forces that used to have, you know, if you joined the German Social Democratic Party or at least its youth wing in the old days, you would be in a study group studying Capital, Volume 1, 2, and 3, until you worked your way through this and understood enough about the foundations of all these ideas in social democracy. Radical left-wing movements, there were more social democratic movements, many of them claimed lineage in Marx, and there was a whole community of people who were brought up with this complex Marxist terminology and ideas. That's all disappeared, and so those of us who care about Marx sometimes feel like we're in a little chapel in the cave, holding a little candle aflame for some saint, hoping that one day people will rediscover his relevance. But I persist anyway. And I persist because I think that when you read Marx, you see a very fruitful framing of a lot of issues that are very germane in the life of us as consumers, as workers, and we look at the lives of managers that we study. The products that, I should back up one second. What makes Marx interesting, I think, from a management point of view, is that he has this sort of two layers of analysis going on. On the one hand, he has a trans-historical, anthropological understanding of the labor process. On the other hand, he says that labor process takes a distinctive form in each of these different historical epochs. In the capitalist period, that labor process takes a very distinctive form in which working, for example, takes the form of wage labor. I'll explain a bit further what I mean by that. The products we produce have these two aspects. The substance of it, if you will, is some utility, some use value that we're providing to people. But the form in which that happens in a capitalist society is as exchange values. It's something we can sell for money. And within the production process, we've got this trans-historical labor process that takes a specific form under capitalism that Marx calls the valorization process. Let me give you a picture of that. The labor process, Marx says, go back as far as you want in history. What you'll discover in human activity is a fundamental structure where people doing stuff try to work on some object to transform it into something that they find useful, necessary, valuable, mediated in that work by tools, and by some division of labor, some collective to which they belong. Human labor is a collective activity deep into our anthropological history. So that's the trans-historical, anthropological view, if you will. And Marx says under capitalism, this is overlain by, right, a distinctive historical form in which creative labor takes the form of wage bills, a variable capital that the capitalist is constantly trying to reduce. The collective work that takes the form of a bureaucratic or other kind of command structure where people exchange their creative ability to work for,
wage and submitted themselves to the authority of the boss. What we anthropologically, what is presented to us as tools, take the form for the in the capitalist enterprise as constant capital, as invested in equipment and tools that have to be depreciated, that have to be accounted for, that we constantly try to minimize expenditures on. And as I said, the product has this two-sided nature. These two sides, Marx says, picking up on Hegelian idea that takes you a little bit into weird territory, the form is in contradiction with the substance, that there's tension between the two. These two aspects presuppose each other, but they also oppose each other. This is Hegelian dialectical book, blah, blah, blah. But it's when you get used to it, it's a productive, it's a fruitful way of thinking about things, that there's some tension here between the capitalist treatment of work and the creative demands of workers and indeed of firms too. For the need for creativity. And across all of these elements, we've got these interesting tensions. I think this is a helpful frame. I would say, to go back a step in the story, a lot of organization theory has sought universal theories of organization that would apply to organization under any socioeconomic system without being very attentive to the specific form of organization production under capitalism. We then have a bunch of people who want to take those universalistic precepts. Growing size means growing specialization. Growing size means growing standardization. We have these generic rules of organization design. Some people want to take those universalistic rules, which belong in this sort of anthropology of organization, and then say, oh, but they may be different in China as compared to the US or Portugal as compared to Sweden. Fine. I would say, on the one hand, we're zooming too far out to anthropology. On the other hand, we're zooming too far in to these cultural differences. There's value in all of these different points on the zoom, right? But there's an intermediate zoom frame which brings into focus capitalism, the distinctive forms of capitalist organization. Right? And Marx, I think, helps us understand how to think about the form of the production process that's distinctive to this capitalist form of society in which we live and which seems to be making us so different. So that gets you this far. And I think that's fruitful because it captures, I think I've always found this a very, very easy to talk to managers about these tensions. They live these tensions every day, right? We're trying to produce something for our customers, but the cost pressure is killing us. We have to strip out some of the more expensive features to our product. And then our customers get angry. We're torn between the use value and exchange value of what we're producing. We want our workers to be creative, engaged, and so forth. But we had to lay a bunch off last month, and that kind of hit morale. So, we have to force them to adopt these new new guidelines that structure what they work in ways that they don't really like. So that all of these tensions I find very experientially, phenomenologically relevant in the life of the capitalist enterprise. So I found Marx a very fruitful frame for talking to managers about the work, but indeed in the classroom, for that matter, for talking to future managers about what life is like in this contradictory enterprise, which is capitalism. I'd say a couple more things. Marxism also gives you a terrific frame for thinking about not just the production process, but the social reproduction process. Marx, very similar to Polanyi. Polanyi took much of his inspiration from Marx in this respect. The three fictitious commodities of Polanyi are discussed at great length in Marx. Polanyi's analysis of them is drawn deeply from Marx. Capitalist production process depends on the reproduction of workers through the family and through domestic activity. It depends on natural preconditions for natural resources. Right? It depends on this externality called the state, and you might remember Polanyi talks about money as a fictitious commodity. These are all fictitious commodities, unlike the commodities produced here, which are real commodities. The argument is they're not real commodities for various reasons, which are Marxist reasons. They're not produced for sale on the market. They're just preconditions. And Marx's theory gives you a lovely way of talking about the contradictory relation between the sphere of production on the one hand and the sphere of reproduction on the other. Nancy Fraser has a bunch of really terrific essays on social reproduction theory where she sort of integrates feminist theory and Marxist theory in a terrifically robust way. I find very fruitful and compelling. For those of us who are interested in the impacts of work on family life or in the environmental crisis, or firms, political engagement, and the corruption of political processes, I think would be a pretty fruitful way of thinking about it. Two last thoughts, then. A lot of people get deterred by fake news. There's some fake problems, I think. There's a lot of people think that Marxism has these little impasses. I'm sure there's many problems with Marxist theory, but these are not amongst them. There's plenty of room for agency in Marxist theory. Marx's 18th Brumaire quip that men make their own history. People make their own history, but under circumstances they don't choose themselves. That's the whole structuration theory right there in a nutshell. There isn't much more to be said about the problem with agency. It's nice to inhabit an institution that picks up that exact same idea, I think, quite definitely correct, if I'm wrong. Do ideas affect your sleep? Well, blah, yeah, of course they do. Marx doesn't deny that. Some of you are worried about the transformation problem. Hands up if you're worried about it. No, okay, I'll pass on that. That's easy. Is the labor really a source of all value? Marx says, obviously not. There's many things we draw from nature, from our social interactions, which are very valuable, as use values. Marx is a story. When Marx says labor is a source of all value, he's talking about the source of all exchange value. And that's just a feature of capitalism. The world should be otherwise. And under capitalism, exchange value is the critical variable governing the success of the firm. So at labor time, he argues, is the source of that. That's an interesting point. Do the failures of the USSR prove Marx wrong? I think rather right. There's some fake problems. We can talk more about them. There's plenty enough problems in Marxism that we don't get hung up on these fake ones. And I like Marx, or at least my take on Marx, for one other fundamental reason. I think that I've been involved, as some of you know, for a while with critical management studies as a current of work within the academy. I love the critical edge of critical management studies. I think capitalism sucks, and the sooner we're done with it, the better. But it seems to me the critique of capitalism is going to sound like a shrill polemic unless somehow we fold into that critique a recognition of the kind of progress that capitalism has wrought relative to the pre-capitalist systems that people still live under in many parts of the world and have lived under elsewhere too. So that I think Marx, in his own writings, you'll discover a very rich appreciation of the progress represented by capitalism relative to pre-capitalism, and indeed the progress wrought by capitalism as it develops. That progressive side of capitalism is celebrated quite explicitly and eloquently by Marx and integrated into his critique. So I think that, for me, makes Marx a rather compelling start point of the target for management study and indeed for critical management study. With that, my time is up. Thank you.